Thank you very much for inviting me and for introducing me. It's always a pleasure for me to be here. I've been coming to NRC for the last 12 years on a regular basis. I've worked and collaborated with several colleagues of yours, and we did some interesting work together, so I'm always pleased to be here again and share our results and our thoughts together. Today I want to talk about optical harmonic mixers. There's been lots of work done in this area. One of your colleagues and director here, Dr. Normandin, was one of the pioneers to work in optical harmonic mixers in waveguides. In the past, I did some work with him too. And then I also did with my other colleagues some other aspects of this area, which is what I want to talk about today. I would like to acknowledge the support for this work by NSERC, by Nortel, and by Siemens. In my talk, I will proceed from a brief introduction to a short review of the theory the optical mixing is based on, and then I will describe one specific experiment that we did that dealt with one aspect of optical mixing, that is optical rectification. I will present some data, draw some results from this data, make some conclusions and suggest some possible applications along with some possible routes for further investigation. As I said, there's been lots of work done in optical mixing via the second order nonlinear effect. Firstly, the work was done in transparent optical crystals, where mostly second harmonic generation was the objective of these experiments for obvious reasons, for instance, applications in optical memories. Lots of work in waveguides was done in the material called lithium niobate, where quite high efficiencies were achieved in second harmonic generation. As I mentioned, Dr. Normandin was one of the pioneers to do research in optical mixing in semiconductors, in semiconductor waveguides, using different arrangements and tricks to enhance the interaction. Generally, the optical mixing through the second order nonlinear effect produces the upconverted signals, which are generally a sum frequency signals of those two mixed waves, with the special case being the second harmonic signal, and at the same time also down-converted signals are produced, generally the different frequencies signals of those two mixed waves, and as a special case again is the optical rectification, where a DC voltage basically is produced. In our work, which I want to present here, we concentrated on a waveguide mixing or mixing two guided modes in a waveguide fabricated in an indium phosphide based material system. And we wanted to concentrate on optical rectification. Before, we also did work in a second harmonic generation. We evaluated indium phosphide or InGaAs material in a similar way as it was done in gallium arsenide. And we basically produced similar signals, strengths of strengths of the similar magnitude. The main objective there was to, or major drive there was, it's known that indium phosphide nonlinear coefficient is higher than in gallium arsenide. So we wanted to verify that, and we were hoping to see stronger signals. At the end, we ended up with the same conclusion as with gallium arsenide, and it's probably with other semiconductors too, that the absorption of the harmonic signals at the end kills the possible efficiency. It's not a transparent, non-absorbing crystal. The semiconductors always have some absorption, especially for second harmonic signals in the range of around a micrometer or less. So the absorption in indium phosphide basically limited the output powers of second harmonic signals in a similar way as in gallium arsenide. So we concentrated on the other aspect, on the downconversion effect in the material where the optical absorption is no issue. And we wanted to verify, first time in the waveguide, the optical rectification effect. We wanted to measure the DC produced by mixing two identical optical frequencies. In bulk, it was done long time ago, sometimes in the late 60s, by the group led by Peter Franken from Arizona Optical Center. They measured optical rectification voltages on the order of hundreds of microvolts with milliwatts per square micrometer. They basically took a piece of KDP crystal, oriented it properly, illuminated with a powerful beam of light, and placed two electrodes on each side, creating in such a way a capacitor, and then shining the light through and mixing the beam with itself, producing a DC voltage that then they collected on the electrodes. In the 80s, I believe it was, late 80s, a French group did the similar thing, first time in semiconductor, in asymmetric quantum wells in gallium arsenide, where the asymmetry enhanced the second order nonlinearity, and they measured basically the same values, the values of the same order. So it was a bulk measurement again. So what we wanted to do was to do this experiment in waveguide. Theoretically, we've developed a whole theory for waveguide mixing, and the theory showed that one should concentrate on a co-propagation regime where you propagate a mode, a TE polarized mode, down the waveguide on a 1-on-0 standard indium phosphide substrate. And in such a configuration, you can get mixing of the TE mode with itself, producing a nonlinear polarization that would be normal to the plane of a waveguide. So if the mode propagates down the waveguide in this direction, and it's a TE mode, so that means the electric field is pointing in this direction, propagating down the waveguide in this direction, then the resulting nonlinear polarization will have this direction. So then, if I have a contact from the bottom and I place electrodes on the top of the waveguide, I will basically have a capacitor that is charged with this mixed optical wave in a proper direction. So I will accumulate the voltage along the line from one electrode to the other, and I should be able to pick that voltage up. So the due to the symmetry properties of the indium phosphide crystal, and by choosing the right polarization and the right direction of propagation, one could simplify the expression for the nonlinear polarization, which is otherwise quite complicated because you deal with vectors and the nonlinear susceptibility is a three-dimensional tensor. So all these products here are quite complicated algebraic expressions. One can simplify that to basically scalar product of the nonlinear coefficient and the square of the electric field of the TE mode. So once that is done, you know the polarization. It's a DC problem, so you don't deal with any dynamics, so you can engage a simple electrostatics plus a guided mode theory, and you can express the expected voltage, DC voltage, to appear at the contacts, at the electrodes. Through this, we introduced a constant called ADC in an equivalent way as in the theory of the second harmonic generation, a so-called nonlinear rectification cross-section, which turns out to be in units 1 per amperes, so I prefer to quote it in volts per watt. It tells me basically how much voltage I would generate, approximately, all this is an approximation, how much voltage I would produce per watt of the power in the mode. Similarly, as in second harmonic generation case, when we have a so-called nonlinear cross-section quoted in 1 per watt, but usually we can quote it in watt per watt squared, meaning how much power in the second harmonic I produce by putting in watt in each mode. By mixing two modes, I get watt squared. So this is a nonlinear effect in terms of the nonlinear dependence in terms of the power for a second harmonic generation. The power is proportional, power of the second harmonic is proportional to the square of the power of the fundamental wave. The DC effect, the rectification effect, is in that case, or in that sense, linear, because I get voltage per watt in the mode. So this is what we did. We introduced this constant equivalent to ANL, and we did some simple numerical estimates by taking the parameters of indium phosphide, published a nonlinear coefficient for indium phosphide, calculated the effective index of the mode, of the TE mode, in a given waveguide, which was about 2 micrometers thick and 2 micrometers wide, permittivity, and from these calculations you get cross-section coefficient, or that non-linear rectification cross-section, on the order of 10 to minus 2 volts per watt. And that already is consistent with those data measured in bulk. One wouldn't expect anything different, really, in waveguides. The only difference in waveguides is that you may be able to achieve higher densities of power, but the nonlinear constant is the same for waveguide or bulk material. So the theory turned out to be encouraging enough, giving us following conclusions, that we could produce, we could expect to see voltages, DC voltages, produced by mixing of a TE mode with itself within basically a capacitor. So this capacitor is charged with this optical wave through this nonlinear effect. We know that it's an extremely fast effect because you charge that capacitor, there's no RC constant involved. You charge it with the speed of polarizability of your dielectric. So that's basically displacing the electrons in the external orbit of the atom by a very small distance. So that's very fast effect scale of much less than a picosecond. So the charging is very fast of that capacitor. So that's an attractive property, attractive feature. we obtained some reasonable values, measurable, that we would expect to be measurable by this simple estimate. And then we started to speculate about some possible applications of this effect, if experiment is successful. So basically, with this DC mixing, we would set up an electrical source. Of course, I'm not talking about efficiencies and so on, but it's basically you have an electric source that obtains its energy from the optical wave, converted through this nonlinear effect, and you can extract this electrical energy from the capacitor that is continuously charged by the incident optical mode. So in the experiment that were performed at the Siemens lab in Munich, what I had available was an indium phosphide, indium gallium arsenide phosphide reach waveguides that were 2 micrometers thick, 2 micrometers wide. I had many of them on a chip that ran parallel with each other. They had electrodes on the top, and they were originally designed for as a double wavelength functional device. They were designed to be absorbing at 1.3 micrometers, so it could be used as either a detector at 1.3, electrodes serving as electrical terminals, or by applying the forward bias, it would act as an LED. So the same structure they had there, that 1.3 layers, they acted as a double functional device at 1.3, either as a detector or an LED. But it was at the same time designed to be transparent at 1.55, so it was a double wavelength device. And the waveguide structure was also formed into a directional switch, so you could use this as a switch for 1.55 through a free carrier refractive index change in a forward bias p-n junction. So it was a multifunctional structure, very clever design. So we used a 1.55 pigtailed laser with the fiber taper to bring the light in, which provided quite a high efficiency, and we used fiber loops to control the polarization. The theory predicted that we should expect to see the different signals at the electrodes depending on the polarization, depending on whether we propagated a TE mode or a TM mode. TE mode would be producing the nonlinear effects through the second-order nonlinear constant, so it would contain the rectification effect, which, as we showed, is linear with the power in the mode. It would also produce the second harmonic, but because the second harmonic is generated at 1.55, at about half of it, which is 0.7 something, the material is highly absorbing, so that second harmonic would not grow. It would be immediately absorbed, and the structure would act as a photodiode for the second harmonic. So we would be producing carriers, and we would be collecting these carriers at the same electrodes. So this effect is quadratic with the mode power. And then we also expected to have a barrier effect or contact effect, basically at the Schottky junction between an electrode and the semiconductor. On the other hand, for the TM polarization, for our direction of propagation, polarization, and so on, and the crystal orientation, TM mode would not produce this optical nonlinear effect. So it would give us only the barrier effect. And that barrier effect doesn't depend on the polarization, so it would be the same one as for TE. So this provided a means for us to eliminate this barrier effect and be able to see these two nonlinear effects. And again, separating them was relatively easy because this one is quadratic with the p-mode and this one is linear with p-mode. So we performed the measurements, voltage as well as current measurements, just to verify our data. And we used the following experimental setup, which looks quite simple, although it wasn't that simple in a practical situation. So we had a pigtailed laser, 1.55 laser, with the pigtail that went through a polarization control, connected with a tapered fiber. Here, I'm not showing it in the schematic, here we also had a power meter to make sure that we knew how much power we are launching in, and we also had a polarization analyzer there to make sure that we were launching either TE and TM for those measurements. Then the waveguide, at the output we would, with a multimode fiber, we would collect the output and we would monitor the coupling using a camera and a detector. We also had a microscope here so one could look at the top of the waveguide because normally you don't see it. Even through the microscope you have to use a certain illumination to see those very narrow stripes. So those who work with this thing know that sometimes it's a bit tricky to see. And then using a microscope you have to bring the fiber to a chosen waveguide and then this fiber. So it's an aligning process too, so it takes some time. And then we had a needle probe sitting on a contact on the waveguide that was being investigated, and the signal went directly without any amplification directly into the lock-in amplifier. In some preliminary dynamic experiments, we did engage an electrical amplifier here. We also engaged fiber amplifier here to get more power in the waveguide. So we did lots of other things, but I'm not going to talk about those. I'm just talking about the basics. We use a low-frequency pulse generator here as basically a chopper for the lock-in amplifier's measurements. I can't chop the fiber here, so we basically modulate the laser and you provide the reference to lock-in amplifier. So this is basically a chopper, chopping the signal to be able to engage the lock-in amplifier principle. It was interesting, and I will mention it again at the end, that these electrical signals are very easy to pick. The moment you hit the waveguide with light, you get the electrical signal there. And it turned out that this was the best monitoring way for us to detect that I have a light launch into a waveguide. It's much more difficult to monitor this with the camera and with the detector here, because sometimes you may, with the multimode fiber, you may pick a stray light, or you may pick a light from the substrate, you may pick a light from the adjacent waveguide, because those 2 micrometers waveguide were only 10 or 20 micrometers from each other. So it's much more lengthy to do it this classical way, monitoring with camera and detector and using a microscope, rather than just looking at the lock-in amplifier. The moment I see the electrical signal, I know that I'm launching the light in the waveguide. So it's a very convenient way actually to monitor the coupling efficiency of fiber waveguide system. So out of many measured data, I chose to show this. So we measured the voltages versus increased incident optical power. So in milliwatts here, I have an incident optical power. And we measured the voltages for TM polarization and TE polarization. And what I'm showing here is the differentiation with respect to the optical power of these voltages. So, as one should expect, for TM polarization, because it contains only the linear voltage, that is voltage that is linear with the incident power, after differentiation I should get a constant. And for the TE polarization, because it has the second harmonic signal there, immediately absorbed second harmonic signal that contributes to the photocurrent or voltage measured, which is quadratic with the incident power, so I should see a straight line. And then the offset here must give me the optical rectification constant, because they both have the barrier effect, but because they don't meet at the same point, the difference then is my optical rectification signal. So this data then was modeled in the way as I described. So the TM mode voltage would simply be a directly proportional to the incident power. That's only the barrier effect, KBE. TE polarization would have the same barrier effect, then would have the rectification effect and the absorbed second harmonic quadratic effect, with these constants being unknown. So by analyzing the data, you can determine these constants. So for instance, differentiating both measured data as shown in the previous graph and subtracting them, then you get this, and by extrapolating to P in zero, you'll get that offset KDC, which in our case yielded a value of about, this is quite approximate, about a microvolt per milliwatt of the incident power. So then one can recalculate the actual nonlinear rectification constant by including here the coupling efficiency, P in versus P mode. We took an efficiency of about 40% with the taper. Of course, there's some tolerance, there's some leverage. And we got a value on the order of 2.5, let's say, millivolts per watt, or 2.5 microvolts per milliwatt. So it's about a factor of 4 within the theoretically calculated value, which I consider quite a good agreement, considering that lots of approximations were made in the theory. The electrostatic calculations were very rough, approximate. So we are within a ballpark figure, within an order of magnitude, which is quite a good agreement. And it also yields the values that are in agreement with measured bulk values. So some conclusions. So we studied optical rectification in waveguide. That was, I believe, for the first time we look at this effect in optical waveguides, and we investigated an indium phosphide material system. We used a approximate theory, which we did develop for this particular case, and we introduced this nonlinear rectification cross-section in analogy with the nonlinear cross-section used for second harmonic. We performed low-frequency measurements, or I should rather say static measurements, basically, although we chopped the signals. So those measurements yielded results acceptable and in a reasonable agreement with the theory, as well as with indirectly with data measured by others. We also performed some preliminary dynamic measurements, which showed, for instance, that the absorbed second harmonic signal that is present there is expected to be very slow, because what happens there, you produce a second harmonic, which is not phase matched, so it doesn't accumulate in order to get out of the structure, so it's immediately absorbed because absorption is very high. So it generates carriers, and these carriers, in our case, because we work without the bias, they move by diffusion. So it's a very slow effect. So as you start doing dynamic measurements at a high speed, this effect should disappear. It should not show in the output data. That's what we did observe. So in our preliminary dynamic measurements, which I'm not discussing here in more detail, but it was published elsewhere, this second absorbed second harmonic effect did disappear from the output data as a result of its slowness. On the other hand, we weren't able to separate the barrier effect, which is fast, from the nonlinear effect. So dynamic measurements at high speeds are still to be performed if one wants to really evaluate the speed potential and some of the applications. So that is still an open question. And now some speculations about possible applications here. First of all, as I was mentioning, the effect is easy to detect, to pick it. It's very easy. The moment you get light into a waveguide, you register the voltage at the electrode. So it's I found out from my own experience, when I gained some experience with this by doing this every day, that coupling the light from the fiber into a waveguide, I didn't really need microscope, I didn't need any line, and I just went with fiber in, and I had the fiber somewhere where I expected the waveguide is, and then I move it up and down and sideways, and the moment I detect the signal, I knew I was hitting the face of the waveguide, and then I just maximized the signal. The only time I needed a microscope was to avoid hitting the end of the waveguide with the fiber, so that means the distance from the waveguide. That was the only critical thing when I would need a microscope. But then the lateral movement or lateral alignment or vertical maximizing the coupling efficiency was very, very easy. So it was much easier than monitoring the output as it's done classically with either the camera or photodetector or multimode fiber. So maybe there is some way there to use this for efficient, fast, reliable efficiency monitoring of coupling or for some automatic coupling in experimental arrangements. Other thing that is interesting there is, again, is the fact that we basically have a capacitor that is being constantly charged by this optical wave. And now the question is, what happens if I modulate this optical wave? So I charge the capacitor and then I let it discharge. I can charge it very quickly. It's a matter of polarizing the dielectric, which is very, very fast. And then if I make the capacitor small enough, and if I let it discharge into small resistivity, I can obtain very fast discharging time constant, and I may have a very fast charging-discharging effect there. And if I combine that capacitor with the inductor, and I have a resonance circuit, I may have a resonance at very, very high frequencies, simply made right in the structure. I can use an inductance of the leads. The capacitor is right there because it's by default the capacitor is there, and I may build an optically driven or forced oscillator that would produce very, very high frequencies because the effect is fast. If you, for instance, consider that you would have a capacitor, in this case that is 2 micrometers, the plates would be 2 micrometers, the width. I make the length also 2 micrometers. and the distance between electrons, 2 micrometers, you're getting capacitances on the order of femtofarads. Of course, one would have to consider parasitics there, one would have to consider the losses in the semiconductor. The question is whether the semiconductor would be the ideal dielectric and so on. So there is lots of aspects if one wants to pursue this idea. And that has not been studied, so that's still an open question. And as a more, on a more general tone at the end, optical rectification, as I mentioned at the beginning, is a special case of the difference frequency mixing, mixing or of the down conversion. The attempts were made also to produce not only the optical rectification signals, DC signals, but also the difference frequency mixed signals. Again, here at NRC, some experiments were done in successful experiments in producing microwaves and picking up these microwaves with the horn antenna from the surface of the waveguide. Although there were some limitations there and efficiency wasn't great, but the signals are there. And the question is how strong it is, how strong it can be, is the radiation pattern correct, or should I build some antenna there? So there's lots of open questions there, and still this area is not finished, so to speak. There's still lots of work to be done. In our own efforts recently, we are concentrating on producing millimeter waves, again by mixing, but there are also other ways to mix the signals. One way is this nonlinear mixing via second order nonlinearity. The other possibility that was done in the past is using a photoconducting effect. A photoconducting effect in a semiconductor. That effect seems to be quite attractive, quite interesting, because recently Japanese published the results of mixing 2 optical frequencies in a low temperature grown gallium arsenide that has very fast response, and they measured 100 gigahertz signals, which is a millimeter wave, but with an amazingly small line width on the order of 500 hertz, which was unexpected. Nobody expected that you can produce this from laser modes. So this was produced by 2 laser modes mixed in a photoconducting low-temperature grown gallium arsenide, and the resulting line width of that 100 gigahertz signal was 500 hertz. So you can imagine what the Q factor here is. Very, very high, very huge. So that's the latest very interesting result, and it's very encouraging for us because we are trying to do similar things. Thank you very much for your attention. Are there any questions?